Hello, this is Andy Bombeck, and welcome to another Mojo Music, where I'll be reading articles from Mojo Magazine, along with playing snippets of music. Please let Sun Sounds Radio know if you enjoyed today's program, or how it could be improved. Okay, as I mentioned last week, I'm going to continue reading articles from the October 2024 Mojo Magazine. I'm going to start off with an article about Bob Dylan touring his album Planet Waves with the band. Also, a book review about Fleetwood Mac called Dreams, and a classic album review of Throwing Copper by the band Live. So I'm going to start off with the article about Bob Dylan titled On a Night Like This. Planet Waves and Bob Dylan's 1974 arena tour with the band have often been dismissed as excessive cash-ins, overblown bouts of premature, and instantly regretted nostalgia. But time and a vast new box set of music from the tour reveals instead a crucial transition as Dylan turned away from isolation and New York and towards new and fertile phases of his career. It was a celebration of the past and a going beyond, discovers Grayson Haver Curran. Bob Dylan told Rob Fraboni to call his boss. The singer needed to borrow the sound engineer for 6 weeks to help orchestrate one of rock and roll's most daring feats. Days after Christmas in 1973, and just days before Dylan would return to the road for the first time in 8 years for a tour of untested and enormous sports venues, he and the band rendezvoused at the Forum in Los Angeles. They had rehearsed a little at a nearby studio, the Village Recorder, where a month earlier they'd cut a dozen songs for a new album with Fraboni in just 3 days. But the question now was how the massive sound system belonging to Bill Graham, the iconoclastic promoter who had helped manifest this miracle, actually worked. Robbie Robertson, the band's guitarist, and the closest thing Dylan had to a music director, called Fraboni and asked him to come listen. As the band hacked away on stage, the 22-year-old engineer strolled the home of the Los Angeles Lakers basketball team alongside Dylan and Graham. When Dylan asked Fraboni how it sounded, he turned the question back on Dylan. He said, "It doesn't sound too good to me." "No, I didn't think so either," Fraboni, now 73, tells Mojo. He said, "Do you think you can do anything about it?" I said, "I don't know, but I'll try." This was uncharted territory for Fraboni, a California native who had returned to Los Angeles 2 years earlier to work as the Village Recorder's maintenance chief. 3 months later, he was promoted to chief engineer. Dylan and the band liked how quickly he moved when they arrived in November 1973 to record together for the first time since 1967. When they'd recorded the basement tapes material in the fabled Big Pink to make their first ever album together. When that session was done, he often drove to Malibu to pal around with the band's Richard Manuel, Rick Danko, and Levon Helm. we became, says Fraboni, really good friends. So Fraboni strolled to the soundboard to join Steve Garnier, who ran the powerful sound rig they were to transport to every show. In a studio where the speakers are feet away, the sound responds instantly to a knob's twist. Fraboni instituted the longer delay and how sound bounced. After 10 minutes, Dylan offered his approval and a job. He just says, "Wow, what a difference. Do you want to go on the tour?" Fraboni recalls, laughing. I said, "Well, shit, Bob, I'm the chief engineer. I can just fucking leave." But he knew Dick LaPalme, the manager of the Village Recorder. He said, "I'll tell you what. When you leave here today, go tell Dick Bob Dylan invited you on this tour." Fraboni complied, returning to the Village Recorder that evening and informing LaPalme he had turned Dylan down, a jazz aficionado who had promoted records by the likes of Ahmed Jamal and Sarah Vaughan and worked with Nat King Cole for 15 years. LaPalme understood the opportunity, the magnitude. So Dick says to me, Fraboni remembers, "Let me put it this way, if you don't go, you're fired." Days later, Fraboni climbed aboard Starship One, a Boeing 707 helm once said had been redecorated as a flying Las Vegas lounge. In 21 North American cities, starting in Chicago and aptly ending at the Forum, he roamed the aisles and upper reaches of arenas and stadiums that held more than 15,000 people, listening to the way those steel and concrete halls reacted. "I am a 22-year-old kid who has never been on the road," Fraboni says. "And here I am on a jet with Bob Dylan and the band? You can imagine how my head was fucking spinning." His, of course, wasn't the only one. Starting that December, millions of ticket requests poured in, representing as much as 4% of the American population. Dylan, the erstwhile voice of the 60s, now 32, had been suspended in career limbo, contemplating his second act. People wanted to hear what he still had to say, even if it meant listening through a sound system that, as critic Mac Heschoff ribbed, frequently made the lyrics as opaque as a newly discovered Dead Sea Scroll. The previous best record of the shows, the Before the Flood double LP released in the tour's wake, has always divided Dylan fans. Where some hear intense and energized performances, others hear cokey and overblown, while some of Dylan's subsequent pronouncements have tended to justify the latter. "I think I was just playing a role on that tour," he told Cameron Crowe in the latter's liner notes to 1985's Biograph compilation. "I was playing Bob Dylan and the band were playing the band. It was all sort of mindless. The only thing people talked about was energy this, energy that. The highest compliments were things like, 'Wow, lot of energy, man.'" But the 1974 live recordings, a 28-hour, 27-CD trove of performances by Dylan and the band, that lands next month, suggests something else, something more. It reveals Dylan gathering the sheaves of his past and setting them ablaze with old friends, as if to propel himself out of domesticity and docile acoustic albums into a future no one imagined. The constantly acerbic voice, the proto-punk wallop, the squealing guitars, and psychedelic keyboards, could a pure money grab sound so scabrous, so vicious? Turns out the kid on vacation, while getting paid $2,000 a week, three times his actual salary, helped Dylan and the band sound pretty mean. Perhaps he can still write good songs, John Wockrell opined in the New York Times in a send-up of the tour's Chicago opening in early January 1974. Even an occasional great song. Since late 1972, Dylan had been trying. His life, though, was a tangle of professional and personal obligations, confusions, and delights. Since his 1966 motorbike crash, he had made a suite of fine and relatively subdued records. The Fever of Blonde on Blonde, Subsiding into the Drift or Canter of New Morning, or Nashville Skyline. The 60s knot of nerves had relaxed, the youthful visionary seeming now a practical songwriter. Dear Bobby, read a note from George Harrison he kept for decades. Thanks for Nashville Skyline. It is beautiful. Perhaps sensing some lack of urgency, even Sunsense Columbia Records, his home since 1961, let his contract lapse in the summer of 1972 after a generous 5-year extension. Days before 1973 began, Columbia head Clive Davis delivered a new agreement just before it was finalized. However, he was fired. This agreement was never executed, reads the copy of the contract in red capital letters, still in Dylan's archive in Tulsa. What's more, by the end of 1973, his lawyer, David Braun, was contemplating an injunction against Columbia to prevent it from issuing Dylan outtakes. He decided against it because it would put Bob in an adversary position. Regardless, Dylan was free. At home, however, he was a settled dad to five kids, a rock star in retreat who had been married to Sarah Lodes for 7 years. He seemed like a really good father with a blended family, remembers Jules Scapapiro, the Dylan's next-door neighbor in New York's McDougal Sullivan Gardens, a famous cluster of homes near Greenwich Village that share a central green. He would play with all of us kids in the garden, and one time John Lennon showed up to play ping pong. I just stared. In fact, during 1973, Dylan was quarreling with Julie's father, Seth, a Manhattan attorney, about a bit of fence in the Dylan's backyard. It obstructed the view, Scapapiro insisted, to Dylan's chagrin. Something of the tension the singer may have felt between these quadrennial demands of domesticity and the temptations beyond can be read in a verse he scribbled in tiny, cramped script on the back of Scapiro's business card. Something there is about you that reminds me of my breath, he wrote. I could say that I'd be faithful, but that surely would be death. Dylan soon crammed an entire yellow legal page with potential lyrics, which he alternately called Whirlwind and You Arouse Me. You are the face of an angel. Suddenly I found you. Or Something There Is About You That Drives Up the Grief in Me. Dylan condensed this clutter of lines into Something There Is About You, a perfect statement of the apprehensions that come with settling down, of being torn between love and wanderlust. Written in a relative hurry on the same legal pad, another song, On a Night Like This, is a come-on between parents trying to balance life's exigencies. The air is cold, the snow is deep, the sleep is bad. Dylan just wants to cuddle and carouse by the fire. If I'm not mistaken, we did this once before, went one discarded lyric. Fertility is in the can. But he began every verse of a song. He never finished dubbed Teardrops with a dismissal. Can't see you any longer. During the third verse, he seemed to be stepping away from stillness. I'm dropping my uniform, he wrote in taunt blue cursive. You wear it if you wish to. It's bound to keep you warm. Dylan indulged that restlessness with a cross-country move. The family had spent much of the previous winter deep in Mexico, filming Pat Garrett and Billy the Kid with Sam Peckpaugh and cutting tracks with Kris Kristofferson's borrowed band. They decided to stick to warmer climes, leasing an oceanfront spot in Malibu along the Pacific Coast Highway. Not altogether coincidentally, an old friend was thinking about heading to Malibu, too. Around the same time, the enterprising young David Geffen asked filmmaker John Talpin to put him in touch with Robinson, still living his Woodstock dream. He saw Robbie as the way to get to Dylan, which was totally right, Talpin remembered. Geffen courted Robinson as both friend and artist, visiting him at home and taking him on a Parisian vacation with Joni Mitchell, hoping to filch the band from Capitol. He soon found Robinson and wife Dominique, a Malibu rental, the Sam Peckpaugh house. We had a lot of faith that David wouldn't steer us wrong, Robertson wrote in his 2016 memoir, Testimony. Soon after the Robertsons arrived late that summer, Geffen steered the guitarist another way, a meeting with Dylan. They hobnobbed with Cher at the opening of The Roxy, which Neil Young consecrated. Geffen soon revealed his plan, a full tour with Dylan and the band. Bill Graham would promote it, and Geffen's label, Asylum, would release a live album, and, if possible, a new studio set as the tour began. Dylan was receptive but tentative. Bob only wanted to go out for a few dates, 8 or 10 or 12, said Graham, which was silly because the whole country wanted to see him perform. Dylan relented, agreeing to a month of shows, 40 in all. Helm would insist that part of the singer's motivation was altruistic. He wanted to help the band out of a slump. Bob could have had his pick, but he chose us out of loyalty, Helm wrote. Whatever the rationale, the process soon turned into a sprint. The pent-up energy of 8 years off stage suddenly overflowing. The rest of the band had relocated to Malibu in October, so they found a remote rehearsal space and began revisiting standbys and Dylan's fresh bits of domestic indecision. If the setting seemed a little Big Pink, the sound was all 1965, 1966 on stage swagger. Robertson marveled at how intense Dylan's voice had become. "Soon we were driving a wheel all over again," he wrote. "It was an automatic reaction. There would be no pulling back." In November 1st, meeting with the band, it was all finalized. One of the biggest tours ever, behind a Dylan album on Asylum. The band backing him, 4 days later, they were in the studio. When Fraboni heard Dylan was coming into the Village Recorder to work, he nearly skipped the session. They'd been together briefly in New York, but he had the chance to engineer new Seals and Crofts material. The duo recently had a smash with Summer Breeze, so he wanted in. When he learned the band would be in tow, he backtracked. "I almost fainted," Fraboni remembered. "Music from the Big Pink was just so revolutionary. Another layer, like the old blues or bluegrass or jazz records. It wasn't rock and roll bullshit." Levon Helm missed the first day, with Richard Manuel sliding to drums in his stead, as he had sometimes done at Big Pink. They cut half a dozen songs, only Never Say Goodbye, a yearning paean draped in surreal imaginary, made the record, with Danko frolicking over Manuel's rudimentary drums. Here's a little bit of the song, Never Say Goodbye, by Bob Dylan. When Helm arrived, though, the unit began to move, finishing the album in only 2 days. Fraboni presided from the control room over history. Robinson was nearest the window, with Manuel at piano and Garth Hudson on organ to the far right, and Danko to their front. Helm was in the back left, with Dylan nearby. They set up the studio only once. Many of the tracks are first takes. On subsequent runs, Dylan would rearrange the songs on the spot, the band chasing his hands. There were no conflicts, no outburst. "This wasn't like Get Back," Fraboni says, referencing the fraught scenes in Peter Jackson's Beatles doc. "It was all nuts and bolts, no social horseshit, just music." Despite all the lyrical revisions of the previous year, Fraboni never saw Dylan refer to a piece of paper, except once. On a Saturday, he and Dylan were gathering the best takes for a master reel. Dylan laid on his back in the control room with a legal pad, then said he had a new song ready. He asked Fraboni to use studio baffles to build a fort so no one could watch him sing. Without ever looking at his notepad, while strumming along to the words for the first time, he sang Wedding Song, a devoted but vaguely barbed homage to his marriage with Sarah. Minutes after he wrote it, Dylan cut it in a single take, crystallizing his uneasy feelings. "How in the world can anybody do that?" gushes Fraboni. "It was the most remarkable thing I'd ever witnessed." Here's a little bit of that song, Wedding Song, from Bob Dylan, from his album Planet Waves.
I love you more than ever, more than time and more than love. I love you more than money and more than the stars above. Love you more than madness, more than dreams upon the sea. I love you more than life itself, you mean that much to me. Ever since you walked right in, the circle's been complete. I say goodbye to haunted rooms and faces in the street. To the courtyards of the jester, which is hidden from the sun. I love you more than ever, and I haven't yet begun. You breathed on me and made my life a richer one to live. When I was deep in poverty, you taught me how to give.
Dylan intended to call the record Ceremonies of the Horsemen, but Planet Waves finally stuck. The phrase spilling from some free verse he'd penned about DMT, the divine, and quest for answers. Waves on the planet, he wrote, still I haven't seen the face of God. As 1973 neared its end, Dylan was busy. He was in a new town, navigating a marriage with fault lines. He had reunited with the now-famous Friends he had ushered toward the spotlight before escaping it himself. He was not only finishing the album he had made with them, but also preparing for an unprecedented tour. He'd set aside cigarettes and was exercising, getting ready for the road. The tumult plays out in a thin-lined notebook from that California winter. Dylan repeatedly toiled on iterations of liner notes for Planet Waves, annotating songs with unseen candor. This brings back the good old polka days for me, beer halls and pinballs. Land of 1,000 lakes, he wrote of opener on a night like this, evoking his youth in Minnesota. Guys off duty with big dicks and ducktails. He'd wrestled with so many drafts of Tough Mama that he scrawled, "Gotta be it," atop the final one. Decorated with Star of David doodles, his notes made it sound effortless. Wrote this in New York City during heat wave and the days of San Geronimo Festival. The lone wolf made out pretty good. Meanwhile, he combed through his catalog album by album, picking tunes he might take on tour. He chose 44, starting with Talkin' New York from his debut and ending with the minor 1971 single Watching the River Flow. On the reverse of Dylan's notes, a child, presumably one of Dylan's, drew flowers and ice cream cones, invented a new math, 0 + 3 = square, and repeatedly wrote a very long nonsensical word. On the notebook's last page, the kid practiced counting to 16 in thick blue ink. It is a perfect fossil of domesticated Dylan, suspended between nightlights and footlights. He didn't have to worry about the tour itself. That Bill Graham and his team would handle the logistics, the stage, the sound system, the transportation, appealed to Dylan and the band, with Robertson convincing the singer he could pull it off. Bill would work for them, so to speak, Taupin said. All the perks would be there, but Bill would still only take a piece. Bob would get to keep most of the revenue. That revenue was tremendous. 5.5 million pieces of mail, applying for up to 4 tickets each. Some $92 million in check and money orders, wrote Clinton Hyland in Behind the Shades. That's $620 million now, per the United States Bureau of Labor Statistics. What's more, Planet Waves became Dylan's first U.S. number one album. The singer was so nonchalant about the pecuniary aspect of the endeavor that, while playing basketball during rehearsals, Graham told him they could shoot for the tour's profits. What tour? Dylan chided. Still, the first concert in Chicago betrayed hesitancy, as if Dylan and the band didn't know how to square up to such massive crowds. After all, they'd been heckled and booed so often less than a decade prior that finishing their tour mostly intact had been a miracle in itself. With two sets spanning 28 songs and an encore, the first show felt like a pinched nerve awaiting release. They started with Hero Blues, an early 60s obscurity that told a lover to get lost. They hammered it into a menacing thing, Dylan howling over the breaks with resentment. Lay Lady Lay was so angular and italicized it risked topping over, while Like a Rolling Stone seemed laden, as if they were trying to push the anthem's object back up its mountain. There was no banter, no outreach to an audience that had waited nearly a decade for this moment. The stage, Helm wrote, included a roll-top desk, carpets, bunk beds, and Tiffany lamps. But that was the only whiff of intimacy. A Dylan song would be followed by a band song, during which Dylan seemed unsure what to do or where to put himself. And with the exception of Nobody Except You, a brilliant love song he'd excised from Planet Waves, Dylan treated the acoustic portion as obligation. Monochromatic recitations, lamented John Rockwell in the Times. It made no sense for them to be alternating a song or two with Bob looking like he was lost, says Fraboni. After the shows, the band, Dylan and Graham, sat together, uncomfortably aware their plan hadn't quite come together. Fraboni spoke up, suggesting the set be modulated so Dylan could appear without the band and vice versa. It would be more dynamic, more intimate, less awkward. In testimony, Robertson credited Geffen with this feedback. Everyone said, "That seems like a pretty good idea. Let's try that tomorrow." And that's what happened, Fraboni says. I was this kid speaking up because I was too naive to realize what I was doing. Not long before the Chicago tour opener, Fraboni bought a small spiral-bound notebook that he could stow in his shirt pocket. It became an index of encounters with the famous. Everybody that was anybody was at these shows, actors, musicians, politicians, he remembers. So I am meeting all these people, and I am running into the bathroom with this little notebook and my pen, writing people's names down. People thought I was running in the bathroom to do blow or whatever. Indeed, the tour's guest list were a who's who of the important in the world, but also in Dylan's life. His mother, Beatrice Ruttman, topped the Chicago Manifest with 10 tickets. In New York, Mike Porco, the Gertie's Folk City mastermind, who had given Dylan his first gig, joined a crew that included several Rothschilds, Miles Davis, Allen Ginsberg, Paul Simon, and Yoko Ono. Seth Scapolino, the neighbor mad about Dylan's fence, didn't use his free tickets while his daughter paid for nosebleed seats. In Atlanta, they posed with Georgia Governor Jimmy Carter, while in Toronto, Dylan and Fraboni visited Gordon Lightfoot at home, where he played three of his own records for them. "Yeah, I don't listen to my own records," Dylan joked during the drive back. As Dylan and the band jetted from city to city, reconnecting with old friends, playing ping pong, and visiting art museums, they simultaneously tightened and loosened on stage. Their veneer of toughness corroded, with Dylan occasionally acknowledging the crowd and the whole sextet appearing to have as much fun as Barry Feinstein's photos suggested they had backstage, playing with their kids or simply singing together. This shift became clear early when they opened the afternoon show in Philadelphia, only their second city, with a prowling version of Ballad of Hollis Brown. Dylan cut that survey of poverty and death in 1963 for The Times They Are a-Changin'. But the renditions a decade later, with Manuel on drums, seemed to fight back against the system, to buck its terms. It became a tour linchpin, as did Planet Wave standout Forever Young. Increasingly, they indulged in its anthematic architecture, Hudson's florid keyboard and Robertson's pinprick guitar pirouetting like fireworks. All along the watchtower grew teeth. "It ain't me, babe," a devilish sneer. "It just wasn't a very passionate trip for any of us," Helm later wrote in This Wheel's on Fire. At the time, at least, his drumming and the band's whole musical gusto really suggested otherwise. Here's a little bit of that song, Forever Young, by Bob Dylan from his album Planet Waves.
May God bless and keep you always. May your wishes all come true. May you always do for others and let others do for you. May you build a ladder to the stars and climb on every rung, and may you stay.
By 1974, Dylan had known Nat Helstoff for a dozen years. The Village Voice columnist had penned a crucial early profile of Dylan for The New Yorker and conducted a Byzantine interview for Playboy. Hentoff's Nashville Skyline pundit was another that Dylan kept hold of. Just plain pleasure, he wrote to the singer a month after its release. And I wanted to thank you for it. They were artist and critic, yes, but also friends. In a piece for the New York Times 10 days after the tour left New York, Henstoff acknowledged as much, thanking Dylan for his tickets. But Hentoff didn't like most of it. In addition to the acoustics, he lamented the premature nostalgia, plus the sense that Dylan had not kept pace with the band. It may well be that, for some years to come, Bob Dylan will attract even huger audiences than welcomed him back on this tour, he wrote, but most of them will be following old cue cards. Hentoff was wrong. Planet Waves and the 1974 tour were the flashbangs that Dylan hurling into the future. By year's end, he would capitalize on the candor and relational turmoil of Planet Waves with Blood on the Tracks, a record as sensitive as a razor blade and his first masterpiece in 8 years. His veil of blissful domesticity with Sarah ended in divorce 3 years later. Hyland pinpoints the Oakland shows as the start of his relationship with Ellen Bernstein, a 24-year-old A&R at Columbia. Those shows also catapulted him into the throes of ecstatic collaboration, of reuniting with old friends, not to resurrect the past, but to see what might happen when you revisit it in your current skin. Desire and the Rolling Thunder Review proved the value of that. Dylan performed his old songs almost exclusively, but if he was looking back, it was not to invite, but to rejoice nostalgia. Willis wrote, nostalgia implied revival, which implied death. Dylan was very much alive. Dylan's reunion with the band did not much outlast the tour, nor did his relationship with Geffen. His return to Columbia would refresh one of the great relationships between songwriter and label. As he has done so often, he soon looked back with suspicion, telling Robert Hilburn in the Los Angeles Times that he'd lost touch with himself, much like Elvis Presley. It was just full-out power. There was just nothing other than just force behind that, he said, of the King's later years. I've fallen into that trap, too. Take the 1974 tour. But that force blew Dylan into a next act. Really, a five-decade succession of them that many had doubted he would ever have. And here's the book review about Fleetwood Mac. The book is titled Dreams, The Many Lives of Fleetwood Mac. Did Fleetwood Mac think their cocaine dealer on the sleeve of Rumors? Did Stevie Nicks and Christine McVie insist on having grand pianos in their hotel suites during the Tusk tour? Did the band steal the house cat from the Albuquerque Tinsley Coliseum in November 1979? It's testament to the lavish sprawl of the Fleetwood Mac story that Mojo writer Mark Blake can round up the most enduring, scurrilous myths about the band and squash them into a brief true or false chapter without diminishing the ludicrous richness of their story? Answers: no, yes, only the female members. From their first appearance at the Windsor National Jazz and Blues Festival in August 1967, "You'll Never Be a Star If You Dress Like That," a bejeweled Eric Clapton admonished their troubled jeans and t-shirt-wearing guitarist Peter Green to their final evening with Fleetwood Mac in Las Vegas in 2019. "Dreams" charts all the band's romantic, psychological, financial, and musical complexities, using Blake's own catalog of interviews with key players to tether the narrative. Given the knots and twists in their story, Blake wisely and entertainingly divides it into 7 broadly chronological parts, each one featuring brisk chapters that zero in on a band member, an associate, a song, or an event. Guitarist Jeremy Spencer, for example, who notoriously vanished mid-tour in 1971 to join the Children of God cult, gets a section. So too does superfan Harry Styles, who chose Mick Fleetwood as the face of his skin and nail care brand, pleasing in 2021. There's a snap essay on their influence on Status Quo, another on notorious 70s stage prop Harold the Dildo. No matter how transient someone's role, 1994's forgotten singer Dave Mason, or Crowded House's Neil Finn, their last vocalist, Blake, smartly analyzes what it shows about the band's seething collective psyche at that moment. It's a refreshing approach, highlighting oblique connections, odd legacies, and echoes. Yet, while he has an expert eye for the illuminating digression, Blake also undertakes a thorough journey around Fleetwood Mac and their turbulent personalities. He makes sense of the bizarre cultural cut and shut between British blues players and California pop dreamers that occurred when operically star-crossed lovers Stevie Nicks and Lindsey Buckingham joined the band in 1974, suggesting that the twirling Nicks was the closest Fleetwood Mac had to a showboating Daltrey, Jagger, or Plant. Dreams also shows how dividing the band's convoluted, intertwined personal lives from their music is a fool's errand, digging into the psychic trauma of 1977 mega-hit Rumours. The English spelling was by command of bassist John McVeigh, and its 1979 follow-up, Tusk, known as Lindsey's Folly. It's an ugly, beautiful melodrama, one that ended first in 2018 when Nicks accused Buckingham of smirking at her during her speech at an award ceremony, resulting in the guitarist's departure from the band. A real line was drawn in 2022, though, with the death of this supremely gifted songwriter, Kristen McVeigh. Who's to say where the line is, where the show stops and the reality starts, said Buckingham, wistfully contemplating his onstage chemistry with Nicks. We always brought out the voyeur in everyone. If you want more of Fleetwood Mac's Class A premier crew melodrama, look through this book. Okay, now it's time for the classic album review, and this week it's Throwing Copper by the band Live. Kurt Cobain's death was marked, and in many media circles, almost celebrated a few weeks ago. His death was a symbolic end to the grunge era. Even though grunge continued to live a waning existence. However, April 19th, 2004, marked the 10th anniversary of Live's Throwing Copper. And with the exception of Live fans, the occasion was marked with virtually no fanfare. Like Cobain's death, but in an infinity more superficial way, the marking of Throwing Copper's 10-year anniversary can't be met but with a little ping of depression for those who came of age in the 90s. Throwing Copper put Live on the cover of Spin and won the band awards in the Rolling Stone Reader's Poll. It sold more than 5 million copies. Lightning Crashes was on radio ad nauseum and was the favorite dedication song to many sensitive high school English students. And here's a little bit of that song, Lightning Crashes, by the band Live, off their album Throwing Copper. Why mark Throwing Copper's anniversary? You could be a cynic and say that Throwing Copper would never have succeeded in 2004, and thus the anniversary should mark another more innocent time in popular music when real music, read alternative, could stand a chance to go platinum. And there is some argument to that. 1993, 1995 saw bands that I'm sure wouldn't see the light of day on mainstream radio bask in radio adulation. Belly, Maisie Star, Morphine, and Garbage got into rotation. Hell, Green Day's Dookie sold 10 million. However, that argument becomes frayed when you look at the success of a very live-like band, Esavance. They made it big, selling about as many copies as Throwing Copper, and like Live, has an ability to write songs that come off as rock, but can also fit in alternative radio station format. Like Live, Evanescence was fairly unknown until they had one big song that they were able to capitalize on and sold a lot of albums by a groundswell of word of mouth, praise from fans. And anyone who doubts that talent still can't move records need only to look at Modest Mouse's early year success with Good News for People Who Love Bad News or The White Stripes. Besides, 1994 wasn't as golden of a year as aging Gen Xers paint it. Live didn't do anything terribly new or groundbreaking. The anthematic songs on Throwing Copper, Selling the Drama, Alone, White Discussion, were songs U2 were doing in the early 80s. 1994 and 1995 may have given us Green Day, Live, and Rage Against the Machine, but it also gave us Hootie and the Blowfish and plenty of bubblegum pop. In essence, Throwing Copper is as quintessential of a 90s album as Nevermind, The Chronic, or OK Computer, but in a different way. Throwing Copper sounded new, fresh, and vital, while sounding utterly familiar, much like the majority of music that tried to pass as alternative. And here's a little bit of the live song, Selling the Drama, from their album, Throwing Copper.
Into fear, flame, and to burn the crowd that has a name. And to right or wrong, and to meek or strong, it is known to scream from the wall.
And unfortunately, that's all the time that we have for today. Please join me next week when I continue reading articles from the October 2024 Mojo magazine. I'm going to start off with an article about Nick Lowe, who has a new album out. And then the Mojo interview with the band The Thuzz, lead singer Matt Johnson, and a classic album review of Days of Future Past by the Moody Blues. Until then, this is Andy Bombeck for Mojo Music, saying so long and keep rocking.